If you want to get your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. Gizmo Sapiens.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens 202. We're going to entitle this one Wheels, because we're going to talk about the automotive industry today. So, oddly enough, there's been a lot of criticism and some high-profile coverage of the accidents that the Tesla Autopilot has created over the last few months. But, in a more positive note, a woman gives birth in her Tesla. Her husband had to put the vehicle on autopilot so that he could assist her giving birth in the front passenger seat, which is also commonly known as the drinker seat. The lady decided to resist giving birth until they could get to the hospital in her car, but in California they got into a traffic jam, and she couldn't wait, and so gave birth in the car prior to getting to the hospital. My question is, what's the cleaning bill on that Tesla going to be like?
Seriously.
What's interesting about this is, so the husband claims that he lightly kept his left hand on the wheel while assisting his wife give birth in the front seat of the car, which I think is interesting, but that means autopilot was driving the whole time. But this comes at a time when, like I said before, autopilot has had a lot of criticism. The NHTSA has identified 11 autopilot-related Tesla accidents from January of 2018 till now, and they're all currently under investigation. Now, that being said, technology changes fast. Autopilot in 2018 to now is a much different beast, and it's constantly being updated. The other thing that's going on is that part of the crashes, Tesla believes, is because the repeater camera and hundreds of Model S, X, and 3 vehicles were found that they had faulty PCBs, or printed circuit boards, that were causing them to fail, which then in turn, that's one of the main sensors that autopilot relies on.
There's always going to be some sort of mechanical failure in a car. This whole autopilot thing has always been a come with me if you want to live kind of thing.
Well, it is. And, it's kind of funny. I've thought about this a lot. Everybody wants, who wouldn't want a car like Kit from Knight Rider? In the 80s, Kit, take me to this, drive me to Atlanta. Yeah. And you lay the seat back and you go to sleep. And you wake up when you're in Atlanta.
I'd rather say, Scotty, beam me to Atlanta.
I know.
I would much rather do that.
I agree. But, the ideal dream is a self-driving car that is still an independent entity in and of itself. Or you could have the more Minority Report type of self-driving car, where it is connected to the municipal grid, and all the cars are connected to the municipal grid. And so, some master supercomputer system and AI are coordinating all these vehicles. Now, there's some advantages to that. All the vehicles are communicating on the same network at the same time. So think about one of the things that is annoying to everybody. If you drive a car, it's annoying to everybody. But when a stoplight turns green, all the drivers, the first driver, they notice the green light. They then hesitate a little bit. Then they start going. Well, then the next car behind them then allows some little space and all this stuff. So what happens if you're like the fifth car or sixth car or the 15th car in a line of cars turning left or
I'm laying at on a
stoplight? You then, it's not just a couple seconds of latency that's built up. It could be 30, 40, a minute, minute and a half. By the time you get up to the light, it's changed back to red again. In a fully automated system where all the cars, they would all start moving as soon as that light turned green. So, but like you said, the chance for something to happen, whether it's a fully independent AI driving your car or one that's tied to all the other cards in the grid, is still big. You know, these AIs, they don't react. I mean, people don't react to changes. How can you expect this computer system to react? You know, for something unexpected. Plus, you know, a grid-tied system. What kind of shenanigans could go on if, you know?
Well, this is where I come back and say, you, if you really want to take this to its fullest extent, you do it the tech war way, and you even go even further by fully socializing the transportation industry. You tie the purchase and maintenance of the roads, the infrastructure, and the vehicles to revenue generated by the adway.
Yeah.
And that way, it's, you don't even have to own a car. You need a car, you tap your watch, your Apple Watch will now have a function that will call a car. It will arrive almost instantaneously because it's the future and everything's cool. And off you go. We'll even call it the iCar.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that concept has been thought of not just by William Shatner and his Ghost Rider.
Sure.
But
what I like about that idea is that you are not forgetting the economics of it.
Yeah.
Now.
Well, let's talk about that in the real world. So advertising could very well, and we have road advertising today. You know, the we still have billboards, and the billboards in our lifetime have shifted from
static displays,
you know, where they pasted printed paper over the outside to these giant LED displays that now can have moving advertisements. And, you know, whole cities like Las Vegas, all that place is, and Gatlinburg, Tennessee is a good example. Those places are just, everything is about generating revenue from advertising.
Yes.
How do I get you into my, into my establishment so that I can then charge you money to do stuff?
So, you know, we have a state legislator friend who, that's the business she pretty much grew up in, is billboards. Most of them that you see in Ohio.
Yeah.
And a couple of the surrounding states are actually her company.
Yeah, well, I actually, in my career in tech, and flying back and forth from the Midwest and the East Coast to the West Coast, and I sat on a plane with the VP of sales for the company who's the dominant player in swapping these static billboards to these LED ones.
Yeah.
And ended up having a great conversation with him, kind of understanding the technology and this was 10 years ago. And at that time they were replacing, like, they were making money hand over fist because they were replacing like 30% of the static billboards in almost every state. Yeah. And that they've probably at this point, it's even greater. But their model was not about selling new billboards. Their model was generating revenue through the maintenance of these billboards.
Yes.
So that brings me to my point, is if you offset the cost of billboards or of the roadways and the cost of the vehicle and electricity and, you know, whatever runs these vehicles with advertising dollars, do we get to a point where when you go to a dealership to get a car, or you live in a large enough city, you essentially, it's like a subscription service. It's like paying for Netflix every month. Oh, here's my $100 a month, you know. I get my app on my watch or my phone, and I call my car, and it comes and picks me up. But
you don't actually own it.
Correct.
I'm okay with that because then the maintenance of the vehicle is no longer my problem. It's just part of my subscription, and I don't have to deal with it. I mean, I could do that now. I could lease a car and feel the same way, but that's a whole different thing.
Yeah. Very true. Very true. Well, and, you know, the problem with leasing a car is at the end of the day, you don't own the car.
Right.
But you still pay for license and registration. You still pay for the fuel and the fuel tax, you know.
That's what I'm saying. This is a much better model for me.
Yeah.
You know,
well, and you know,
I
it could change things. Now, do I think, you know, maybe it's a model we'll start seeing in larger cities, where like New York City is a good example, where parking,
and then there's that.
Yeah, it's
then I don't have to worry about parking the car. Yeah. It will just move on to its next assignment.
The other thing that's happening too is the opposite of that, which is, there's fewer and fewer reasons people need to leave home. Because, like, Walmart, I've had it for a couple years now, and we use it all the time. I actually use it for my daughter the most. While she has an apartment while she's down at college. And
unless you're talking about robots and drones doing this delivery of services, there are still people leaving home to go do this stuff.
Correct. They are today, but I think we're going to see that change.
And again, come with me if you want to live.
Yeah.
Because...
well, we've already seen where, you know, the Tesla autopilot thing is kind of cool, but where that autopilot thing is actually starting to happen in a much greater sense is like robot delivery of items to your home. You know, I'm not going to say people aren't going to want to leave their home to go do things, entertainment venues, but the need. So, you know, it's kind of funny. We don't think about this particularly people in our generation, because our parents were the offsprings of the people who came back from World War II, you know, but prior to World War II, most families were single car families. You know, the only exception was like if you were a farm, because usually you had a single car and you had, you know, like a farm truck.
Right.
but when everybody came back from World War II and you had the GI Bill and these guys were flush with money and they were flush with jobs, it's the besides appliances in the home to help make it easier for homemakers to cook meals and wash clothes and get the work that they needed done. Cars, a second car added to the family was a big thing. You know, now your wife didn't have to wait for you to come home from work to then go to the grocery store or go to the bank, you know. So,
which she couldn't go to the bank anyway because they're only open during the day while you're at work.
Yes. Correct. And so, you know, that second car opened that up. But, you know, and part of it was a reaction to the fact that during World War II, while all the men were off to war, women were working in, you know, in the industry, you know, building planes and warfighting machines and even canning food and all the stuff that you had to do just to keep the country alive with, you know. And in addition to all their homemaker duties and everything else. And so, you know, this idea of automation to help solve things, cars were part of that, a big part of that. But as we move into this idea of self-driving and food delivery, because Kroger just started their service, it's $59 a year, which is frankly fairly good since Walmart charges $99 a year. Deliver to your house within 24 hours, you know. And if you want to pay $99 a year for Kroger service, they'll deliver within 2 hours. And today, yeah, they have drivers who are doing the delivering the items and stuff. But give it 10 years, and a lot of that will be automated. Because the other thing that's happening, too, and part of the problem that we're... yes, there is this concept of the Great Resignation. People are not... don't feel like they need to work so hard to make as little as they're making. But the whole idea, if, you know, we automate that, plus the baby boomer generation is the biggest generation we've ever had, and every subsequent generation is smaller, is retiring, we actually have fewer people in the workforce to be able to do a lot of this work. And so I think, yes, we have the Great Resignation going on, but then we also have this, our largest generation of workers are now retirement age or retired, and we're starting to see that effect, and the Great Resignation just amplified it. It didn't, you know, it was something that's going to happen. We've seen it happen in Japan, hence the amazing amount of automation you find in Japan. You know, more of the Japanese population are older than 60 than they are under 60. So, and we're going there. It happens in all developed countries over time, you know. And populations will, you know, depending on what's going on socially, will change. And right now they're saying, I've read a couple articles that talk about fewer people are having sex, hence fewer people are having babies.
But I wonder, and this is where Idiocracy may have gotten it wrong, which is why I ask the question. If that's true, as people have more and more free time on their hands, are they going to be doing it more or not?
I don't know.
I mean, what's your take based on that study?
Part of it is right now we are economically uncertain. So fewer people are in relationships, fewer people are getting married, fewer people are having, who are married are having babies, and people, if you're in fewer relationships, there's less of a chance of your free time. I don't think, my personal opinion is, I don't think fewer people are having sex. I think there's a lot more people having sex monogamously with themselves. Honestly. Yeah. You know? And so that in turn causes a population decrease. We have a good old war, send some people off to war and they come back. You can watch the population increase. And I think that's a cyclical thing that happens. Hence the baby, you know, we talk about baby boomer generations, but, you know, you had the, everybody went off to World War II, they came back. We had the biggest population increase we've ever had as a country. Vietnam happens. A ton of people go off to war, they come back. We had another boom of babies, you know, which you and I are part of that generation.
Yeah.
And, you know, but you have to have a war on that scale almost to do it.
So now we've been fighting a 20-year global war on terror. Will we see a population increase?
I don't think we do, because the difference in both World War II and Vietnam is there was a draft. And so you had people who were not volunteer. I don't want to call them volunteer. People who did not sign up to be soldiers,
right,
were forced to be soldiers. And you also had a large fraction of your male population away fighting these wars. Our 20-year war on terror, it's people who volunteered to do it. We've also have issues where, you know, it's a kinder, gentler military, and so people are rotated in and out, you know, of war zones a lot more frequently than they were, and because they can, than they were during either of those conflicts. I mean, you know, you went to war, you went to Europe in World War II, you weren't coming home until the war was over, more than likely. Or you were injured to the point where you couldn't fight anymore.
Right.
Same thing with, largely with Vietnam. You know, they weren't rotating, oh, you've been out here 6 months, I'm going to rotate you back to the States and bring, you know, somebody to replace you who's fresh. They didn't, the Army and Navy and Air Force didn't think that way during those wars. Today they, you know, you might spend a year remote and then you'll get a new assignment within, you know, somewhere else. Like, you might go from Iraq or Afghanistan to Germany. You might not come home to the States, but Germany's not a war zone, you know. The other thing that happens, too, is, and this started in it started in World War II, but it wasn't as nearly as frequent as it was in Vietnam, but you didn't have a lot, as many war brides coming home either. It's things to think about. Let's move on.
Please.
So, what do you think about buying a new used car, Matt?
I think...
A new to you.
No, look, I mean, I saw an article the other day that, like, there's now used cars going for, like, $26,000
so let, pop. Let's put this in perspective. So the average price of used cars right now has risen to $29,000.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Okay. So that means you're going to have to get a loan, make payments, just like you would a new car. The new Ford Maverick, which we've been talking about, is $20,000. So with tax and title, it's about $23,000. So what motivates me to buy a used car rather than a new one? I'm much more likely to get a loan on a new car than a used one. I'm going to pay lower insurance rates on a new car than a used one. You know,
That last point may or may not be the case. Because the value of the vehicle is lower when you're talking used.
But, so here's the thing. So say you have a new vehicle, and I literally have gone through this.
Right.
So the newer the vehicle, even if it's a used vehicle, typically you're in, even if you're just getting comprehensive coverage, your comprehensive coverage will still be cheaper than it will be on an older vehicle. And it can be, it could actually be several hundred dollars between a 4 or 5 year period. So say one car is a 2014 and one's a 2010. You're going to pay more on that comprehensive coverage. New vehicles, a lot of people don't understand that. Typically, if you get a loan on any vehicle, whether it's used or new, you have to pay for full coverage to cover collision in case that vehicle is lost to cover the loan.
Which, by the way, is inaccurate. Because when you total out that vehicle, you find out that the insurance doesn't cover the full cost of the vehicle when you...
No, they want to base it on Kelley Blue Book values and things like that.
So then you have to purchase gap insurance on top of that, which is a whole other thing.
Correct.
Yeah.
And that, hence, it makes insurance. Plus, insurance on a full insurance, including collision, on a used vehicle is always less than on a brand new vehicle, partly because... you know, if as long as the vehicles are within the same, I mean, you buy a Corvette, you're going to pay a lot more, you know,
a lot comparable more than a, vehicles.
Yeah. But, you know, say you buy a used vehicle for $29,000, you buy a brand new vehicle for $29,000. The new vehicle, actually, the insurance will be less on it, partly because it has a greater NHTSA safety rating.
Correct.
Two, parts availability is forecasted at a greater rate than on a older vehicle.
Agreed.
You know, so in an apples to apples comparison, you pay more. It's out of hand. There's no, I mean, I complain about new vehicle costs because you drive a new vehicle off the lot and it loses $10,000 worth of value once you drive it off.
At least.
But used vehicles being at $29,000 is out of hand. And, you know, the thing is, vehicles that would cost $5,000, a reasonable vehicle that was maybe 10 years old, that would cost $5,000. Those are going for $9,000 and $10,000 today. And the issue with this is, and this is what people don't realize, this is a direct relationship to inflation and why inflation is so insidious. is used vehicle prices have climbed 42% since 2020.
Yeah.
Used cars prices in December were 63% of the cost of a new vehicle. Same vehicle class.
Right.
Before the pandemic, it was 54%, which makes sense. You know, and when they give out these numbers, they're talking about a used vehicle that was maybe 1 to 3 years old. So, right now, with taxes 10% down, an interest rate of 7.5%, which is about average, a used vehicle is $520 a month when you finance it for 72 months, which is 6 years. And that's the other new thing. Vehicles have gotten so expensive, whether it's a new vehicle or a used vehicle, we're now not financing for 60 months or 5 years. We're financing for 72 months. You know, and the problem is so we talk about in the United States, yes, you have big cities on the East Coast and the West Coast, and there's large population centers there where there is public transportation, and you don't necessarily need to own a vehicle, or particularly you don't need to own two. But the remainder of the country, even though there are large cities, particularly east of the Mississippi, to get your job done, to find housing, affordable housing and everything, you can't live downtown or live next to the factory that you work at or the office building you work at or whatever. You have to have a vehicle. And so not only does this 6% average increase in inflation over the last 12 months hurt you because, you know, groceries are more expensive and everything else, you're getting hurt because that vehicle that gets wrecked might break down and is not, it's not afford, it shouldn't be affordable to repair, or it shouldn't be repaired because it costs more than getting a new car, or now have to be used. Otherwise, you can't pay your bills and go to, you know, eat your food and go to work. And limited income families, this is probably the single largest, you know, we always talked about raising sales tax, which I believe is a fair tax. Everybody pays the same thing. If I consume more, I pay more tax. If I consume less, I pay less tax. Because it's really, if you laid it out correctly, there should be tax exemptions on sales tax. Like, you shouldn't have to pay sales tax on food-based groceries or prescriptions, which we do now. So if we increased sales tax, but we eliminated that, those things where literally it was like, you know, the clothes you buy, the cars you buy, computers you buy, you know, stuff that you don't need to necessarily live, you would actually find that you're taxing the people who consume the most, which makes sense. But because of the way we have it, and then this inflationary tax of used vehicles, plus there's no new vehicles. The supercomputer or superconductor shortage has ensured that there's very few new vehicles, and the new vehicles are there. Again, Keynesian economics, there's supply and there's demand. You know, it's hurting our lowest 10% of people disproportionately. Yet what we're going to spend money on and try to control is the beef industry in the United States because people aren't eating enough hamburgers. Again, Keynesian economics would fix that. If beef prices get too high, people start eating chicken or pork or
whatever.
Fish, whatever.
Yeah.
We all become vegan.
That ain't happening.
Nah. I ended up dying because all vegan food has garlic in it. So
nasty.
But, you know, it's out of hand. You know, and one of the things I've always talked about is this switch to electric vehicles or hybrid vehicles or whatever. It all sounds great on paper. And I'm not against it. I think the technology is cool. As a matter of fact, I think people are like me. The people who have money think the technology is cool because Ford has decided to double the production of their F-150 Lightning this year because they had such high demand. Now, whether they're going to get the semiconductors to be able to control those systems, you know, same thing. General Motors decided, hey, we're going to release our Silverado electric version this year. And I'm like, you can't meet the federal guidelines for fuel efficiency because you can't get the semiconductors to control the systems in the cars to do it. So you're selling cars that don't meet federal fuel efficiency guidelines because you got to make money.
I've always wondered why the industry doesn't push back against federal regulators like that.
Yeah, well, but my point is this.
This is the perfect opportunity because, quite frankly, so, there's nothing they can do. If you want to keep the company in business because they're too big to fail, then you need to check out on these regulations. But
the whole used car industry has always been a question I've had, both secondary market and dealer-based used cars.
Right.
So we make this big switch and we're pushing to this and, you know, we're getting to the point where it's now a punishment to drive a gasoline vehicle. Or it will be soon. And so you have to ask, well, what happens to all the gasoline vehicles that are out there? Because they far outnumber all the new vehicles and they far outnumber all of the electric vehicles by an exponential number. And I'm just talking the United States where we are a car culture. Sure. But South America is a car culture. Canada is a car culture. You know, the places that are not car cultures are the places that their whole countries are not the size of one of our states.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Well, Rhode Island.
Yeah.
Delaware. No, I'm with you. And again, I think another part of this is the free money that our government continues to peddle.
Yeah.
We're paying for all that free money in inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about that Senate candidate off air. He brought up a point that's illuminating. There's a fiscal philosophy that Democrats in this country have bought into that so long as the U.S. dollar is the main currency of the world, the United States can spend however much they want, and it doesn't matter. That kind of thinking is why we're screwed.
Yes, absolutely. Well, let's move on to my last thing. So, on the brighter side of this whole semiconductor shortage with cars is that car dealerships are even finding this. So, you know, typically, we just went through the Christmas season. Typically, there are sell-a-thons where they try to get people to give extravagant gifts. You know, like, buy a car for Christmas, you know. Give your wife a matching Mercedes with yours and all this. But what people who actually do that are finding, getting these, you know, year-end deals to buy cars, is that they're not sell-a-thons anymore. They're wait-a-thons because there's no new vehicles to be had. And shoppers can't find the vehicles they want. So a lot of shoppers are just, well, I don't want that, so I'm not going to buy it. And what it matters is, you know, it's a combination of supply chain issues and semiconductor issues and COVID and the inflation and all kinds of stuff. But what it's forced to do is it's forced the U.S. auto industry to take the more European model of selling cars, which a couple years ago, Sean and I talked about this in one of our automotive, when we were talking about Tesla and the fact that Tesla doesn't do dealerships.
Right.
And, but what has happened is, and Ford is actually leading this effort, they're offering essentially you a $1,000 discount if you pre-order a vehicle, meaning you don't go to a dealership, you order a vehicle and you wait 30 days to or 60 days or whatever it takes to get it manufactured to have it delivered. Consumers are finding they like this because they've gotten, they like the build to order. I build to order from Dell. I build to order from Apple. I build to order from Amazon, you know.
I struggle with this concept, and I'll tell you why in a minute.
Well, and that's fine. But people who are buying new vehicles, they're getting the color they want. They're getting the features they want. If they want the bells and whistles, they can order those. You have to wait a month or so to be delivered, but we're slowly getting... We've, over the last 10, 15 years with Amazon and other companies, in online delivery, we've slowly become more patient with waiting for something that we really want the way we want to get it. Because American car culture has always been, go to the dealership, find a car, take it home that day. You know, and there's still quite a few people who are that way. Or take it home tomorrow after they prep the car, you know. But you're not waiting 30 days to get a car.
Is that really the way it still works? Because I've always heard, well, always, there I go, using. I've heard it's you go, you test drive your car, and then you essentially have to order it because they don't have on the lot what you actually want.
So that's part of the push that was slowly happening. But for the most part, most people go in, they're impatient. You know, I want a new car. They'll buy something that either has more features than they want, or maybe it lacks a couple of features, but it's a minor issue. And they drive their car home, you know, within, say, at the worst case scenario, it's 72 hours, you know. Because the other thing dealers have started doing is, say you're a Mazda dealer and somebody comes to your lot and they really want a car that has these features. They now go online and they have a car driven from one of the other local Mazda dealers. So you might wait an extra 8 hours while that car is being driven from somewhere. But people are not ordering cars on the most part. Tesla, you go into a Tesla dealership, there's cars for you to test drive, and then you order what you want. In Europe, you go in and, you know, a dealership, if it is a dealership even, they have like four or five, you know, like one of each model car that you can test drive. And then when you do, you absolutely order. Now, has ordering been around forever? My mom, you know, was an engineer at GM. We've been a GM family for a long time. And I remember going in and she wanted a new Buick years ago, and what she wanted, we ordered. You know, she wanted this color and she wanted these features, and we ordered that car. But for the most part, people don't order them still. Not in the United States, but we're getting there, partly because the semiconductor shortage has forced people to order cars. You want a new vehicle? You're going to have to order it. You know, because production is about not... Because the issue, too, has been this, and this is why the automakers in the United States are really embracing this, which is they build a lot of cars, and they have to guess at kind of what the right mix of features and functionality in that vehicle is, and then they then sell those to dealerships. So they have to produce a whole bunch and then sell them.
Right.
So the dealership has inventory tax they're dealing with. If they're sitting at a lot at one of the factories, there's inventory tax there that the automakers are paying. If they do a on-demand system where not only is the car bought when I order it, so it's already sold, but I'm giving them exactly what they want, then we're not guessing about what features and functionality exist. So it becomes a much more leaner operation. I think it's saving the automakers 20 and 30%. Now, the problem is in the United States, and this is the issue that Tesla has run into, is the Auto Dealers Association. This is not how they want to do business.
Well, of course not.
And so, you know, most states have a government agency that represents the auto dealers, you know, which are not representing – the automakers. It represents the auto dealers, and in some cases, it's like a. I want to call it to me it, like in Ohio is a good example. It's like a mafia, you know. The auto dealers don't like what's going on. They go to this group in the government. That group then hammers down on these people who are doing what they don't like.
Exactly. Well, again, this is government picking winners and losers.
Yeah.
I mean, that's government should not be in that business.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, it shouldn't be have to tell you how you have to do business. If you don't want to use auto dealers, don't use auto dealers. I mean, that's the way the tech industry is. Tech industry, we have a good mix of original equipment manufacturers selling directly to some customers and then selling through resellers. You know, and there's an economic reason for doing it. The reason you use resellers is because then you don't have to have a whole huge sales force to sell to all the, you know, to make money. So you don't have to maintain 3,000 or 4,000 people. I can then sell through resellers, and each one of those little companies is now an extension of my sales force. And they might sell my stuff in situations where I would not be able to sell it to, because now they have expertise and they have other products that we don't make that complement each other and can go sell a solution. You know, that's economic. There's nobody saying that, oh, you know, Dell, you must use resellers to sell something, which is what, like, now Ohio's changed a little bit because Tesla's not using, you know, they're still doing the basically the Tesla store. You can test drive a Tesla and then you order it model. But for a long time, they were very unhappy with it. And what's funny is, when we had this conversation for Sean, he was really against the automakers selling directly to consumers, you know, in that Tesla type model, which I think is really strange. Because he's the one who brought up, well, they've been doing that for years in Europe. You know, you want to go buy a...
I have no problem with it.
I don't either. I don't either.
I don't have a problem with adding the middleman. I have no problem with eliminating the middleman.
My thing with adding the middleman is this. If I buy a car from a dealer, you better either have the best top-notch service, because that's the value add.
Right.
You know, if I come to you and I say, look, there's a rumble in the tire on the left front side of my new car. I don't want any lip. I want you to check it out and go, yeah, we see that rumble too. So I'll give you an example. I bought a brand new Nissan. And the speedometer I noticed, because when I would have my GPS up, you know, it also gives you how many miles per hour you're moving.
Right.
Based upon what the GPS signal sees.
Exactly.
And I noticed that the faster I went, the slower my GPS was actually telling me I was going. The speedometer would say I was doing 80 miles an hour, and the GPS said I was doing 64. So I took it into the Nissan dealer, and I said, look, I don't know what's going on here, but I don't think the speedometer's calibrated right. And they put it up, and they're like, well, we couldn't find anything wrong. Well, 6 months later, there was a recall.
Of course.
And Nissan, the speedometers weren't calibrated correctly. You know, and it's not like I'm an idiot. I told him, I said, look, my GPS, which we know is accurate, is telling me I'm only moving 64 miles an hour. And my car's telling me I'm doing 80 miles an hour, yet I'm moving with traffic. You know, it's not like I'm doing 80 miles an hour and I'm blowing by everybody.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, everybody's driving like a maniac today.
Well, you know. They changed
moms and all.
They changed the speed limit to 70 miles an hour. It means that it's 80 is the actual speed limit.
Well, of course.
But I no longer have that Nissan. Thank God. I got a Toyota instead. But I just find that, you know, the other thing is, you know, that's the value that they bring is the services that they can provide. You know, they're certified mechanics and getting parts in a timely manner. I had another issue with the Nissan, which is, you know, they recalled all the stupid airbags.
Mm-hmm.
And I waited over 18 months for two airbags. And this is what Nissan told me, that the dealership told me. You shouldn't really be driving this car because the danger of if the airbag goes off. And I'm like, so what are you going to give me to replace it with?
Exactly.
Oh, no, we don't have car. Oh, wait a minute. You need to work that issue out with Nissan,
yeah.
Not me. You provide me a vehicle.
Yeah.
And, you know, it. That's so I don't find a whole lot of value from dealerships anymore, other than the hard press sale. And you know, there's a reason I use this dealership. I'm not going to go into that, but. You know, it. What's the value? You know, and then what is the economic value? So car lots take up acres and acres of space. That so, and they not, don't take up acres and acres of like garden space or park space. They take up acres and acres of, they turn acres and acres of land into parking lots and they pave them. You know, so what is the environmental impact there? Why do they need to pay all the inventory tax? You know, that model just doesn't seem smart. And I have friends who work in the retail end of the car industry who work for dealers and or own dealerships, and they talk about having to lay off. That it's been hard over the last 10 years because they talk about they're having to lay off more and more salespeople because they can't sell enough cars per month. And he says what the issue is I can get. We'll have great months like, you know, at the end of the year where people are flush with money and they're buying lots of cars. And so we make tons and tons of money. But the other 9 months of the year, we're getting 1 to 2 sales a month per sales rep, you know. And they need to, for them to really make a real living at a dealership. Most of these sales guys need to sell somewhere between, depending on the level of the car, between 10 and 20 cars a month. You know, so... How do you deal with that? I also found that a lot of dealerships don't want to deal with used cars anymore because there's a lot of effort that goes into a used car. Like you, even if the car's in good shape, you still got to go and, you know, check the tires, do a complete engine flush and replace all the fluids. And, you know, there's labor that you're putting your mechanics through to, before you can put it back out on the market. Because if you put a car out that's not safe, who's liable? You know? And so the potential for lawsuits goes up. Plus, just the level of effort and the whole fact that you have to have another sales staff to man your used car lot, you know, and financing people. And, you know, and the other thing that's happening is a lot of dealerships are finding that they're just having their certain brands of cars don't sell anymore. And so, or the company that makes the car. So the Nissan dealership that I bought my Nissan at, they also used to sell Mazdas. And they're like, well, Mazda car prices, the cars have not changed, but the prices have gone way up. We can't sell them. So we're no longer a Mazda dealer, you know?
Well, again, there's an economic reason for all of that.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, it. These things don't happen in a vacuum.
No. No. So, I guess we'll stop it there. You have any more comments, Matt?
No, I think that's... I think I've said my piece.
Okay, so let's... If anybody has any feedback, send it to us at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's GIZMOSAPIENS @gmail.com. And we'll see you on the digital flip side.
You've been listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's GIZMOSAPIENS@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.